Hi, I'm Gregory Orr, grandson of Jack L. Warner and producer of the documentary Jack L. Warner, The Last Mogul. And you are listening to The Extras.
Hello and welcome to The Extras, where we take you behind the scenes of your favorite TV shows, movies, and animation, and their release on digital, DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K, or your favorite streaming site. I'm Tim Millard, your host. And joining me today are two very special guests to talk about the 100th anniversary of Columbia Pictures, and more specifically, the 1940 comedy classic, His Girl Friday. Stephen C. Smith is an author and producer of hundreds of documentaries and extras, and a good friend that I had the privilege to work with during my time at Warner Home Entertainment. He was previously on the podcast to discuss his award-winning book, Music by Max Steiner, which I highly recommend for film and film music enthusiasts. You may have seen film fashion historian Kimberly Truller on TCM or at one of the many appearances she has made as a lecturer and film historian. She is also the author of film noir style, The Killer 1940s, and the creative force behind Glam Amour, which was founded to celebrate the history of fashion and film. Well, Stephen, it's great to have you back on the podcast. Been a while.
Pleasure.
And Kimberly, it's a pleasure to finally meet you as well.
Nice to meet you too.
I think it was just kind of serendipitous, but today actually happens to be the anniversary of the release date of His Girl Friday, 84 years ago. And when we picked this time to record, didn't necessarily do that on purpose, but that's kind of fun. Now, when this podcast releases, we'll be beyond it. But I'm looking forward to talking to the two of you about this 100th anniversary of Columbia Pictures. So I thought we could get into that first, because that's really a huge part of the background of our discussion today. So, Stephen, I know you're both film historians, but maybe you could take the lead here and take us into a little bit of the early history of Columbia Pictures.
Absolutely. And Kimberly, feel free to chime in anytime you like. Yes, Columbia turns 100 this year. It's actually a little older if you count its very first name, because back in 1918, Harry Cohn, his brother Jack, and their friend Joe Brandt formed CBC. There are three names. And that was the name of the company for 6 years. But because it was such a small operation, once people started calling it corned beef and cabbage, CBC all the time, they decided to go for a more elegant name. And they chose a very good one, Columbia, in 1924. So yes, 100 years ago, that fledgling operation became Columbia. And they went through of some various figures of ladies holding shields, and then ultimately, of course, the Columbia torch that has continued to evolve through the years, because now Columbia is part of Sony. So that's the early history. And the person who was really behind the studio, who ran it, who was the production chief, was the legendary Harry Cohn, one of the most colorful moguls, let's say. And that's saying a lot. He was a savvy man, and the fact that he could be so explosively angry and then in moments turn on charm suggests to me that he was a very good actor, that he knew how to intimidate people. And when people stood up to him, you know, he backed off and he could be very charming in the same conversation. When I was writing my biography of Max Steiner, he had a very funny story about Harry Cohn, who was blowing his top in 1937. Over the scoring of Lost Horizon, the Frank Capra epic that was the most expensive film Columbia had made at that time, I believe. And when Cohn walked in and saw roughly 100 musicians and choral singers at the scoring session, the next morning he demanded that Capra and Max Steiner, who was the musical director, and anyone involved get in his office. And he was yelling and yelling. And then according to the composer Max Steiner, Cohn suddenly lunged from behind his desk and ran towards him. And Max was terrified and he ran out the door and Cohn grabbed him. And he said, "Max, what is the name of that gorgeous cellist that was sitting three rows back?"
All right.
That tells you all maybe I can really need to say about Harry Cohn to start us.
And I think I read a little bit in my research about Harry Cohn that even though he was at one of the smaller studios, obviously at the time, he endured beyond pretty much everybody other than maybe with the exception of one of the Warner Brothers there, but right, Warner, yeah. He had the longest reign, kind of, so to speak, in terms of actual years as head of a studio.
1918 to February of 1958, when he died. No doubt he would have gone on and on because he was still very much running the show at that time, seeing it into the new age of television, just the start of that.
And because it was not, because they didn't own theaters, that was part of the reason why they were also one of the smaller ones. Is that right?
Yes. It was like Universal in that it didn't own theaters. And during the 30s and most of the 40s, it was very advantageous for the studios to own their own theaters because they had a great place to program their, as we would call it now, content. Right. But ultimately, Columbia and Universal, you know, who are both of which are still around, it was to their advantage that they didn't own theaters after 1948 when there was a government ruling that studios could not own those chains of theaters. So that's why Columbia and Universal, you know, just continued to grow during that period. And there was a considerable period of adjustment for studios like MGM.
Well, and I mean, wasn't some of Harry's strategy in the early days that he didn't own much versus Paramount, you know, had this huge studio. MGM had this huge studio where they own cameras. You know, it's like Columbia was renting everything for about as long as he could do it. So it was a very different setup.
Including actors.
Right.
Yeah, this was not a studio that was built up with a star system. So you're using the star system like a Warner Brothers or MGM. They did almost accidentally have a few stars who began under contract, like Rita Hayworth and Jean Arthur. But Harry Cohn preferred to have Cary Grant, say, or Katharine Hepburn come in for a film to do their big prestige title of the year. And that worked out very well for him. And Kimberly, I would say for us, wouldn't you?
I would. And he had Stanwyck and Capper early on. So, I mean, it's like, if you're going to have someone have Barbara Stanwyck, that's not too shabby.
Yeah. And I think one of the featurettes that we'll be talking about, Stephen, when I was watching it, I think you kind of got into some of the importance of a few of the films that kind of took Columbia and started to, give it a prestige a little bit more than it had at least before. So maybe you could take us into some of what was maybe one of the early films that kind of bumped it up in status and who was the director?
Well, there was definitely one in 1934 that changed everything. And because I know Kimberly knows a great deal about this, Kimberly, would you like to take it from there?
Well, I mean, it happened one night, came out in 1934, and it blew everyone away. I'm sure it shocked everybody, probably Harry Cohn most of all. Definitely Clark Gable, who won an Oscar for Best Actor. He was an MGM contract player who had been loaned to Columbia as punishment for his bad behavior. Claudette Colbert had to be wrangled into her part she was a Paramount player. She won an Oscar. They had to yank her from a train station to accept the Oscar. So everyone was pretty shocked when it swept the main categories at the Academy Awards. So that was definitely a pivot point in Columbia's history. And of course, I would argue that one of the reasons that it had a pivot in its reputation was because they hired costume designer Robert Kallock as well.
And Stephen, who's the director on that film? Do you remember?
Oh, I remember. It was a gentleman named Frank Capra, who had been working at Columbia for a number of years, made some very good films already, like Lady for a Day, American Madness. But it was really It Happened One Night that, as Kimberly told us, absolutely astonished everyone. And it really still is. It sets the bar, I think, for romantic comedy. I recently had a screening of it here where I live in Rancho Mirage, introduced it and spoke about it. And it was a packed house and people just cheered at the end. It's fortunate in that although it evokes the depression that it's in, it's about two people who fall in love on a night bus traveling across the country during the Depression. It has very much a timelessness about it. And the chemistry between Gable and Colbert is so strong. And the script by Robert Riskin is just superb. And Capra knew how to get people who, as Kimberly mentioned, didn't necessarily want to be there and make them feel loose and comfortable. And it's one of those great stories where even though Colbert had apparently no faith in the project all the way to Oscar night, she couldn't be more charming. I think it's her best film. So that that showed that Harry Cohn's mission of the last 2 years of getting Robert Kallock in to do these glamorous costumes for stars, to support Capra and Robert Riskin, basically to make one or two major quality films a year and then more kind of bread and butter pictures, that became a template that was successful for a long time.
And do you know how he got Capra in there? I mean, was Capra just a young director that was kind of unknown?
Well, he wasn't quite unknown, but he came out of slapstick comedy. That's the wonderful thing. I think he had worked for, didn't he work, Kimberly, for Max Sennett? And he directed Harry Langdon, the silent comedian, in his last good silent features. And then he went over to Columbia, and Capra was very, very hungry, very ambitious to succeed. And he gave Columbia many of its biggest titles of the 1930s, not necessarily in this order, but Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Lost Horizon, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, the best picture winning You Can't Take It With You. Capra really had kind of, he had the golden touch for quite a while there. And although he sparred with Harry Cohn considerably, who didn't? And I think out of that occasional conflict came good things. You know, Cohn, for all that's said about him, he supposedly was incredibly vulgar and really extreme. But he had good taste, I think, when it came to good films. I mean, in the 1940s, he continued to make quality productions. He teamed Fred Astaire and Rita Hayworth in two films that were very successful. He made All the King's Men another Best Picture winner, and From Here to Eternity another Best Picture winner, for which I did about an hour's worth of special features recently.
I want to go back a little bit to the fashion design, Kimberly, because that's obviously an area that you know so much about. Can you talk about how Kallik did make that transition and help the studio kind of appeal to the actors and actresses?
Well, first, for any costume designers that might be listening, I want to make a statement about there is a difference between fashion design and costume design. They should not be conflated with one another. Costumes are created for characters to be a part of this, to support the story, to show the character arc. The reason why I often weave fashion into the stories of the costume designers because so many of them came from the fashion industry. And Bobby Kallik is one of these people. In fact, he was internationally renowned as a fashion designer before he came to Columbia. He worked at the best couturiers in the world, Lucille being one of them. Lucille also produced Howard Greer, Travis Banton, and Vera West had an association with Lady Duff Gordon, who ran the Lucille Couturier. So, you know, these are all the head costume designers of MGM, Columbia, and Universal. So you know the quality of the workmanship there. And then also Madame Frances, a couturier in New York City, as well as Hattie Carnegie, who is internationally known based out of New York City. So Kallik had an international reputation. If you were royalty, the social elite, actresses, Broadway stars, if you were anyone who was anyone who had money, you were probably wearing Kallik long before he came to Columbia. And one of his clients was Harry Cohn's wife, Rose. And so that is how Kallik got on Harry Cohn's radar. And Stephen alluded to Harry's colorful character and background, which pretty much everybody's got a Harry Cohn story, for better or for worse. But I give him a tremendous amount of credit for bringing Kallik to the studio. He saw that so much of MGM and Paramount in particular, their reputations were coming from the glamour of the costume design. Cecil B. DeMille, very early on, created fashion films, his words, with Gloria Swanson, and proved out that these were money makers. And if anyone valued making money, it was Harry Cohn. So it was a win-win. You know, he got a lift in reputation for the studio as a whole. All of a sudden, even B pictures just looked so much better because Kallik was designing for them. But also people went to these movies to see these stars in costumes. And You had stars who were loaned to Columbia. Jean Arthur was loaned to Columbia for a couple pictures before she went to MGM. Carole Lombard was loaned to Columbia while she was at Paramount to kind of get her experience going. She was someone who got along really well with Harry Cohn, likely because she, you know, was such a tough lady and could go head to head with him. So people went to these films to see these stars in these incredible costumes. So even if they were lacking in script and story, the stars and the look of them helped bring people in. So that was, he started with Columbia in 1932.
And what was his first film with Columbia?
Well, in 1932, he worked with Barbara Stanwyck, who, again, she was one of, like, if you could call her a contract player of Columbia, like, she was one of its early stars. So The Bitter Tea of General Yen was one of his first pictures at Columbia. Right. Yeah, which, I mean, has just jaw-dropping costumes in that one. And then 2 years later, he had It Happened One Night. And It Happened One Night is one of the most iconic films from a standpoint of its costume design, both for Clark and for Claudette Colbert. They continue to live on in the fashion industry today. It is a point of inspiration for modern fashion designers.
And I have to say that, Stephen, thank you for letting me see the featurette a little bit early here, before it's released as part of Columbia's Classics Volume 4. But I heard that story of It Happened One Night and everything. And that kind of then took us right into the film that we're going to talk about, which I believe was, what, just a year or so later?
Yes, His Girl Friday. That actually was filmed in 1939, released in 1940. So okay, a little right. time gap, but not an enormous one. And in between, Kallik continued to do good work. But yes, it's interesting. His Girl Friday is part of the next Columbia Classics set, as you mentioned, which will also include titles like Kramer versus Kramer, Sleepless in Seattle. There are a lot of, you know, gorgeous new transfers on this and special features. But it's interesting, and this is something, again, that Kimberly can speak to far more than I. But in the case of His Girl Friday, we're almost talking about a single wardrobe. And yet with that single wardrobe, Kallik makes His Girl Friday one of the most important costume design films of its time. Would you agree, Kimberly?
100%. You know, what's interesting about both It Happened One Night and His Girl Friday is that the bulk of the picture rests on a single costume. Now, It Happened One Night had more costumes in it, more of a variety of costumes, but His Girl Friday essentially has two through the whole picture. And one of the things that I credit Kellogg with is his gift at layering. So her opening costume is that dramatic striped coat and matching hat, which are pink and black, as I talk about in the featurette. But as the scenes go on, she takes her coat off. Now she's got a blouse and skirt on. So it's a different, same costume, but a slightly different look. Similarly, in It Happened One Night, sometimes she puts Clark Gable's sweater around her shoulders. Sometimes she's got her little hat on. So he finds ways to make a single costume visually interesting for the audience. And then, of course, in His Girl Friday, it is that striped suit, that skirt suit that she wears when she's working, she's in action. That is Hildy. That is her persona. And partial credit to that costume goes to the director, Howard Hawks, who, if you look at the history of the strong women in his pictures, so if you think of Tabernacle Not, The Big Sleep, even Jean Arthur in Only Angels Have Wings, he loves women in checked suits. You know, gingham suit, houndstooth, check suits, or striped suits. And so his direction to Rosalind Russell when she started the picture is go to wardrobe and get yourself a smart looking striped suit. And so that was the direction that Kellogg had in creating that. And what's fascinating to me, knowing fashion history, now I am talking about fashion, is that that striped suit was essentially signature 1940s style that Kellogg was defining in 1939. And further, speaking as a career woman, everyone I know through the decades has had a navy pinstripe skirt suit in her wardrobe. It's just like this classic basic that everybody has. And Kellogg came up with it in 1939. It's just incredible.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4/6 Success Filmmaking. 4/6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4/6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
Yeah, I was looking at a poster of the film, and after I had, you know, heard you talk about the fact that the colors, obviously it's a black and white film, but that the colors of the suit were pink and black, and that that had some real meaning, because there is what, one other wardrobe change where she's then in the with the reporters later. Do I have that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then I'm looking at a poster of His Girl Friday, and she's in a yellow dress.
Exactly.
And I'm like, wait a second. Why did they put her in a solid yellow dress in this poster when I know from listening to your story that there was so much power in that outfit? Now, obviously, it's probably because maybe they did before they even had the word. I don't know. But even in the publicity stills, they don't have her in that outfit. They have her in like in a solid black, many of the publicity stills. Not the stills from the film.
Yeah.
But from some other publicity stills.
Well, I can guess why that decision was made. The studio heads certainly didn't like their women in pants, and they didn't like their women in anything that looked too menswear. And so if you're going to promote a picture, you're going to make her look her most feminine. And Rosalind Russell, through the 30s, had already established herself as quite a little glamour girl. And she was on the heels of the women, where she was in the most outrageous Adrian designs in the world. So the studio heads thought, to lure people into the studios, you had to put her in the most feminine ensemble you can think of. And again, His Girl Friday's got two outfits. And neither one of them are revealing or overtly feminine. So they were likely trying to tap into, you know, Rosalind Russell looking this way and being glamorous, and did a little bit of a bait and switch, at least in their minds. Then it became like, wow, she's incredible. And that wardrobe and so forth, you know, so the storyline completely changed with publicity after it came out. But I can guess that that's the reason why originally it was like that.
And I think you're right, Kimberly, because this is something the studios all did across the board. They would choose costumes that often had nothing to do with the film, but as Kimberly said, position them to be either more masculine looking, more feminine looking. And one thing they also did pretty consistently was period films. Like, this is a different studio entirely, but for The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, a 1940s film set at the turn of the century, 19th to 20th, all the costumes, the people are depicted in contemporary clothes, as in most of the posters and such that I've seen. They seem to feel that some people would be discouraged if it was a period film. So you get these kind of incongruously modern looks to movies that we now think of instantly as taking place in another time. Or if it's a Christmas movie, they hide that it's a Christmas movie. And also the darkness of her costume, which reads so well in the film, probably wouldn't pop as much on a poster. So they went for that yellow, you know, to really just be bright.
Well, and I think to what you just said, I mean, when you watch His Girl Friday, it's about this woman who is being pulled by two worlds, right? She's got the career world and then the home, the family. And that's
let me jump in there, because she's creating that pull. She's trying to tell herself, get out of this. You want a life. You don't want to be 24/7 with your ex-husband, with a bunch of guys all the time. You want to be more feminine. Hence why that first costume is, you know, it's got pink in it, which I'm sure is not a color that Hildy Johnson normally was wearing. Still got stripes though. So it's like, it's her tiptoeing into that feminine role. She's trying to will herself to marry a normal guy, a nice guy, but she gets pulled. I mean, it's Cary Grant. So who cares what Cary Grant acts like? But it's like she's trying to get out of that other world. And so it's her push-pull.
Right. It's hers, but that's still there, right?
Yes, and 100%.
And it's like, maybe was there some fear that she was too career-minded for the publicity, to your point? So they toned that down, which is a bummer, because the reason why I think that film is enduring, obviously the acting is fantastic, the script is fantastic, but the theme still resonates.
Oh my God.
My wife has a full career and she still struggles with the exact same thing.
Amen. Hallelujah. I wrote about His Girl Friday during, I'm not even going to say who was running for president, but it was a contentious election where we thought it was going to be the other person who was female. And so I was writing about it and saying, the sad thing is, we are still fighting for equal rights, equal pay, equal everything. And what's so inspiring about this movie is we all know Hildy is better than everyone. Right. She's a better writer. She's a better reporter. She's a better person than everyone who's on this screen. And so like, that's why it is such a powerful movie, especially for women to return to, because it's like, oh yes, that's someone who's aspirational right there.
And may I just jump in to say, it's also unusual in Hollywood films of the time, because usually when there was a film about a strong woman, whether it was, there was a movie with Ruth Chatterton that Warner Brothers made in the 30s called Female, where she's the boss of an entire industry. She's like the Howard Hughes who's running the company, and she's the woman and all the employees are men serving her. But at the end of the movie, and then 2 years after His Girl Friday, Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn appear in Woman of the Year, and they reshot the ending so it would be, this isn't exactly it, but tonally it's, oh, I guess I don't belong in this world. I'm really a woman and I need to be a wife. So that was usually what happened in films, was that if there was a career woman, she had to ultimately accept the fact that it wasn't right for her. This movie does not do that. And I love, and that's one of the reasons I think it holds up so beautifully.
Right. And when I wrote about it too, if you look at how many women were professionals at that time, it's a very low, it's a single digit percentage of women. So it made it even more exceptional that it came out in 1940, because of course it's before World War II, where, I mean, eventually 36% of the workforce during World War II was women. But as we cruised into the 1940s, it was very low. And to have a job of her caliber, because most women were in domestic service if they had a job, teachers, that kind of thing. So it really is spectacular. And I'm sure that was uncomfortable. I mean, God bless Howard Hawks for having Hildy be a woman, because of course it's based on The Front Page, which had two male leads, but Howard Hawks, who loves strong women, saw that there was an opportunity there to have Hildy be a woman in this picture.
Exactly. In the original play, it's Hildebrand, and the genius choice was made to make that Hildegard. And I just want to say parenthetically, as you know, Tim, there's also a featurette that I produced with the wonderful Jeremy Arnold, author of many books for TCM. And Jeremy talks about how Hawks timed the film so the dialogue could be so fast and furious that when it overlapped, they ensured that extra words were added at the very end of a sentence so that you didn't miss the important information. that the genius sound man could switch between multiple mics so quickly. And that's another reason I think that the film has never gone out of style, probably never will, is it just has this incredible force that starts from the first shot of the film, this tracking shot of Hildy walking in, and it just carries you through it to the very end, like this breathless, you know, e-ticket adventure in pacing, also very contemporary in feeling. The TV series Moonlighting that's come back to us after years and is finally available to stream used His Girl Friday very much as the template for the relationship and that between Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd.
Yeah, that was a fascinating featurette and also highly recommended as part of this new release. And that just points to the brilliance of the direction, right, Howard Hawks. But you also, I think, talk about in there just the challenge that was for the sound design team to do that. And to your point, make sure that the dialogue, they had, multiple microphones to try to capture everybody in the larger group ones and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And the cinematographer said that, you know, it was a very challenging production because even though movies are traditionally blocked, people don't think about this watching it. Hopefully they don't. But, you know, actors walk to certain marks on the floor so they stay in focus. And the focus puller on the camera is constantly working to keep them in focus. This was a movie where apparently both Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell had more latitude than usual to move around. So the cameraman really had to keep up with them on this film. And again, I think that when everyone is on their toes in this way, the sound team, the camera team, everyone, and it's this incredible rhythm. It's just an exceptional piece of direction and writing.
Yeah, I rewatched it, and then I was reminded of the brilliance of it, and I wanted to watch it again. That sounds funny. I literally wanted to watch it again because I'm like, I missed half that banter. I mean, I didn't miss it, but I want to hear it again. I want to like, and the other thing I found myself, Kimberly, is anytime Hildegard is in the scene, my eyes can't, because of that outfit, my eyes can't go anywhere else. Even when Cary Grant is standing right next to her, and usually your eye goes to Cary, I just found myself always looking at her. That's the power of that outfit.
And the power of her. Let's give Rosalind Russell some credit now, considering that she was far from the first choice. You know, I mean, they were trying to pair Cary with previous co-stars like Jean Arthur and Irene Dunne, and then they went through Ginger and Catherine. And, I mean, basically any star of the 1930s before they hit Rosalind Russell, which Roz found out about by reading it in the paper. So she's not cruising into this production with a lot of confidence and confronted Hawks about it. And that's when he said, go down to wardrobe and get yourself that suit. And she just becomes Hildy. And the reason you can't take your eyes off her is because she so is in, to use modern terminology, in her power in this movie. Like she doesn't have to, there's no bravado about her. You know she's competent. You know she's confident. She's not bragging about, you know, you're not getting an indication of her character by her bragging about past things. Cary does talk about assignments that they had been on, but it's not coming from Hildy. And so that's why she's just so riveting. And we've already talked about the dialogue, like 240 words a minute, something ridiculous like that. And so, yeah, that's why you can't take your eye. What is she going to do? What is she going to say? And so that suit is her armor. And that's why it just all works together.
Now, indeed. What about the Cary Grant outfit, though? How is that purposefully toned down, or how does that work for the men versus the women there?
No, I don't think it was toned down. What's interesting about His Girl Friday, if we want to talk about Cary ever so briefly, Cary was always, through his career, very involved in his look and in his style evolution. And his suiting in the 30s and then in the 40s and then in the 50s, you know, it's like you think of The Awful Truth, 30s suiting, Notorious, 40s suiting, North by Northwest, 50s suiting, all different. And so he was playing with cut and he was playing with the vents of the jacket to get into man speak here a little bit. And Carrie was very conscious of his neck being too thick. So he was always working with tailors on the collar to make it a little higher, to make the sleeves a little longer, everything to lean him out. So what you're seeing in His Girl Friday is a great opportunity to see the transition of his style from that 30s suiting, which is more double-breasted, a little bit boxier, moving into 1940s suiting. And again, like even though we have a costume designer of the caliber of Kellogg, Carrie always very involved with his look in his costumes.
And if I could just say, one of the great things about seeing these films, a film like His Girl Friday and a really excellent high definition transfer, is that you can appreciate the details of the wardrobe. And you can also really see the interaction between Grant and Russell on a level that you can't in a, and this is a film that went into the public domain. So it looked terrible in most of the releases that people watched for years or on television. And Grant and Russell had a friendly competition going on in this movie. They liked each other tremendously. They were lifelong friends. But just the way actors do, particularly where these two characters are in kind of a struggle with each other, there's very little improvisation in the film. But their physical activity there's a lot of improvisation. There were a few lines that Cary Grant threw in and with a writer planning. And then Rosalind Russell did the same. She got a few lines in her pocket and threw them at him. And they were keeping each other on the toes. And as I put together these two new pieces about the film for the 4K release, I never, ever tired of rewatching them because I could always look at their eyes and also look at the other news people who are so fabulous. You have a great supporting cast of 30s, 40s character actors in this movie. And there is so much vitality, but there is real listening going on. This is not the kind of movie where people could check out and then just hear the cue for their next line. Everybody has to listen. And you can watch that on the 20th viewing of the movie and still find something fresh in it.
You're so right. Everyone and the scene stealers of the supporting players, every single one of them is so good. So everyone is doing their A game in His Girl Friday.
Well, it's such an iconic film and, you know, going back to the Columbia 100th, this film, among others, I mean, the studio is kind of known for their comedy, right? Their screwball comedy?
I would say that's true in the 30s. I mean, they became known after It Happened One Night as a studio that reliably produced star-driven romantic comedies. And you could argue that Cary Grant created his Cary Grant persona through his films at Columbia because you get The Awful Truth, which was an Oscar winner in 1937, which some people consider the first Cary Grant movie in that he's really playing the kind of character we know. And then the next year for Columbia, he makes Holiday with Katharine Hepburn. 39, he makes Only Angels Have Wings, a Howard Hawks film with Gene Arthur at Columbia. 1940, His Girl Friday at Columbia. So really his most formative time and some of his greatest performances that period are all in Columbia films. So that was something. You know, the audience didn't go to a Columbia film and say, oh, we're going to see a Columbia movie tonight, the way they might in later years say, we're going to go see an MGM musical. They generally went for the stars. But Harry Cohn was so shrewd to pay Cary Grant, not an inexpensive performer, to do these films and to make sure that the vehicles were worthy of him. The talk of the town, you know, in the early 40s. And, you know, everybody benefited, including us, all these years later.
Yeah, I was a little surprised, you know, to hear from your featurettes and everything, that history of how many great films Cary Grant did there at Columbia.
Yeah,
when this studio didn't really have these expensive contract players. And so many other good ones, good actors as well. So
yes.
That was surprising. Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed the featurettes. Can you kind of give us a little recap of the two that you did for that release, Stephen?
Yes, absolutely. One features the wonderful author Jeremy Arnold in a look at how Hawks created the rapid fire dialogue of the movie. And the other featurette features Kimberly Truller talking about the great Robert Kallak, who, as we have discussed, just does not get the attention he deserves.
Yeah, and they're part of the 4K remaster, I believe. that's a part of the, as we mentioned, the Columbia Classics Collection Volume 4. And it comes out February 13th,
just in time for Valentine's Day. So for
there you go. Yeah.
The 4K owner in your home, this is the ultimate Valentine's gift. You get Punch Drunk Love, Sleepless in Seattle, Starman, Kramer versus Kramer, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and His Girl Friday with bonus features.
Yeah, so it's a great release. Obviously, to your point, the version of His Girl Friday that I had to watch is not a 4K. And I'm very much looking forward to the 4K version because it had a lot of dropouts and it had a, you know, it just is not up to par. I mean, I watched it on a streaming service. So I'm looking forward to the 4K because that's going to really help, especially with these, with the costumes that we just talked about.
It's a different movie. And I will say, just for the fun of teasing something, that if you like movies like His Girl Friday, there are more things ahead coming in the year.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much for that. I have no idea what that means because it's so vague, but thanks. I guess what it means is there's more Columbia stuff coming out for their anniversary, hopefully. So, well, before we wrap this up, Kimberly, maybe you could let our listeners know, how can they follow you or find out a little bit more about you?
I am known as Glam Amour online. So you can find me at glamamour.com. It's my handle on social media. I will often do events primarily in the Los Angeles area. I most recently did a speaking screening series with the American Cinematheque with my book, Film Noir Style. So those are the ways to keep in touch with me and informed is what I'm up to. And I'm going to be doing an event before the TCM Classic Film Festival this year, not at the festival. It's right before it. It's going to be at the Hollywood Heritage Museum. And this will be the 7th year that I've done this event. I select 6 or so movies that the festival will be showing. And I share the story of the costume designer, discuss the costumes, if they're influential, and people really enjoy the event.
Yeah, and I'll put the links to your website and some of your other social media on there to make it easy for people to follow Great. You so that they can know about your events or just read your blogs and watch your appearances on TCM or your videos on YouTube and other things as well. And then Stephen, tell us a little bit about what you've been up to. Obviously, you were on the podcast over a year ago, I think now, to talk about your book. But what else are you up to these days?
Well, I had the pleasure of introducing and speaking about 2 films at the Library of Congress recently. One is a film that you and I may talk about later in the year, the wonderful All That Money Can Buy. Since we're talking about books, thank you for putting one of mine behind you. That book to the left is Music by Max Steiner, The Epic Life of Hollywood's Most Influential Composer. I'm also the biographer of Bernard Herrmann. And you can find more about those books at MediaStephen.com. That's Stephen with a V, MediaStephen.com. And I've had the good fortune in the past of producing slightly over 200 television documentaries, most of them about classic Hollywood. I've done at least 100 documentaries for home video on classic films, including some Columbia titles like Oliver and Lawrence of Arabia. So I'm always glad when a studio goes back into its history and gives an opportunity for people like Kimberly and Jeremy Arnold and myself to help not only celebrate them, but maybe, you know, illuminate an area they don't know about, like Robert Kallick, like how the sound design and scripting of His Girl Friday was done. So that's how you can find me, MediaStephen.com.
And I follow you, Stephen. Obviously, we're good friends going way back, way, way, way back. But I follow you on Facebook and LinkedIn and a few others. So I'll have those as well in the podcast show notes. And I'm always surprised at what you have going and how much you have going. And I also love your webinars that you do on film history, film noir, all kinds of different things. And your knowledge of film history is quite diverse. And so I'll have those links for people who want to follow you and check out some of those things as well. But I did want to ask you, are you working on another book?
I am writing another book. It may be related to Alfred Hitchcock. That's all I'm going to say at the moment. And I am hoping that people can purchase it in 2025, more soon.
Okay, well, there's a long lead right there. Because we know writing a book is such a huge process, especially with all the research that you have to do for the type of books you write.
Yes, and I will say there's a lot of information in this one that has not been published before, or I wouldn't do it. So, yeah.
And I do notice, Stephen, knowing you, that you choose topics where you have to travel to Europe, to England, to do research. I mean, it's such a chore. It's so horrible.
But, yes.
You know, you do it.
Somebody's got to do it. If Bernard Herrmann preferred to live in London, I have to go to London. If Max Steiner came from Vienna, I have to go to Vienna. It's just the curse of the work I do.
Kimberly, it's firsthand research. He's got to go and walk in the streets on the cobblestones of these great masters. So,
well, it is amazing. All kidding aside, it is amazing the footprints that they have left there. Because when I wrote my book about Max Steiner, this man passed away in 1971. You wouldn't think that there would be a lot to really find anymore. But because his family, for three generations, had been a major part of the Vienna music scene when Vienna was like the Broadway of Europe, not only does Vienna have a theater museum, they have like an entire room devoted to the Steiner family. It was incredible. So I felt like it was incredible time travel to do that. And that is the fun of doing the kind of featurettes that I got to work with, collaborate with Kimberly and Jeremy on, or books to write is, and certainly watching these films, it's the best kind of time travel you can do.
Yeah. And I'm excited every time I hear about the projects that you're working on, and I will have links to your books, both of you got your books here in the podcast show notes as well, so that people can dive in even deeper into these topics. So, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having us.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our conversation today as much as I did. They just don't make movies like His Girl Friday anymore, so I'm looking forward to seeing this new 4K restoration. If you are interested in purchasing the Columbia Classic Volume 4 4K collection that is releasing on February 13th, you can find a link in the podcast show notes or on our website at www.theextras.tv. So be sure and check those out. If you're on social media, be sure and follow the show on Facebook or Twitter at The Extras TV or Instagram at TheExtras.tv to stay up to date on our upcoming guests and to be a part of our community. And for our long-term listeners, don't forget to follow and leave us a review at iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast provider. Until next time, you've been listening to Tim Allard. Stay slightly obsessed. Hi, this is Tim Allard, host of the Extras podcast, and I wanted to let you know that we have a new private Facebook group for fans of the Warner Archive and Warner Brothers catalog physical media releases. So if that interests you, you can find the link on our Facebook page or look for the link in the podcast show notes.